Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024, where we separate the spin from the facts. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Melissa Topshire with today's headlines. Israel's military intelligence chief resigns over October 7th.
Benjamin Netanyahu vows to reject U.S. sanctions on army units.
The U.S. House approves $61 billion in Ukraine aid.
Opening statements begin in Trump's hush money trial.
SCOTUS agrees to hear a ghost guns case next term.
Global military spending jumped to a record $2.44 trillion in 2023.
Pro-Palestine student protests expand to more New England colleges.
President Mohamed Mouizou's party wins the Maldives parliamentary election.
An Australian Senate committee calls for a royal commission into the nation's COVID response.
And Tesla cuts the price of several models.
The Israeli military intelligence chief resigns over October 7th. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Straits Times, Euronews, Al Jazeera, and NPR Online News. The head of Israel's military intelligence, Major General Aharon Haliva, announced on Monday that he would resign after taking responsibility for his organization's failure to prevent the October 7 attack by Hamas. In his resignation letter, Haliva said, "The intelligence directorate under my command did not live up to the task we were entrusted with. I carry that black day with me ever since, day and night. Day after day, night after night. I will carry the horrible pain of the war with me forever." In a statement, the Israeli military said that Haliva, quote, "will end his position and retire from the army once his successor is appointed in an orderly and professional process." Haliva is the first senior Israeli official to step down following the deadly assault on October 7, in which 1,200 people, mostly civilians, were killed, and some 250 people were taken hostage by Hamas militants. Despite protests, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has refused to resign following the October 7 attacks and subsequent war in Gaza, and has stopped short of accepting blame, though he has said he is open to discussing difficult questions.
On this program, we separate the spin from the facts. Melissa laid out the facts for us, and now some spins on this controversial story, starting with the establishment critical narrative from Al Jazeera. Following October 7th, Haliva and other senior military and security leaders were widely expected to resign. Haliva's resignation is a clear suggestion that Netanyahu should follow suit and resign as well. The Israeli military failed to prevent the massacre that occurred on October 7th and has failed to return the 150 Israelis who remain as hostages in Gaza. The failure to prevent this attack and ward off this horrific conflict is too grievous an error to overcome.
Here's the pro-establishment narrative from NPR Online News. Israel remains engaged in fighting on multiple fronts, with a full-out war occurring in Gaza, and fighting with Hezbollah ongoing in the north. Additionally, tensions with Iran remain high after attacks between the two countries. At this point in time, resignations from high-level leaders, while the country is so vulnerable, could signal weakness. Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders must neutralize external threats before trying to appease domestic political issues.
And from time to time, we have statistics-based nerd narratives brought to us by the prediction community at Metaculus. This time, they say there's a 46% chance that Benjamin Netanyahu will remain Prime Minister of Israel through 2024. In a related story, Netanyahu vows to reject U.S. sanctions on army units. Here are the facts. As agreed upon by The Guardian, Al Jazeera, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and Times of Israel. The U.S. is considering sanctioning additional Israel Defense Forces units over alleged human rights violations against Palestinians. President Joe Biden is reportedly expected to sanction police forces as well as the Netzah Yehuda Battalion this week. Soldiers in the Netzah Yehuda Battalion, which was created in 1999 and consists of ultra-Orthodox Jews, or Haredim, have been convicted of electrocuting Palestinians and allowing a Palestinian-American to die in their custody in 2022. Sanctions against Netzah Yehuda, who had been ordered to leave the West Bank following the man's death but didn't, will prohibit U.S. funds from being used to buy weapons from the unit. Investigations into IDF misconduct in Gaza are also expected to open. In response, both Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the country's opposition leader criticized the proposal, describing it as the height of absurdity and a mistake, respectively. While the sanctions come under the Leahy Law, which prohibits funding rights abusers with American dollars, Netanyahu has vowed to fight it with all his strength. The U.S. House, however, has still approved an aid package that would give $26.4 billion to Israel. Elsewhere in the conflict, the Palestinian civil defense responders reportedly discovered 180 bodies at a mass grave inside the Nasser Medical Complex in the city of Khan Yunis.
Thank you, Scott, for those facts. Here's the pro-Israel narrative from Israel Hayom. Israel itself has acknowledged the past wrongdoings of individual Netzah Yehuda soldiers, but that doesn't mean the entire unit should be smeared. By doing this, Washington is not only painting this battalion with a broad brush, but also the entire IDF. Israel should be allowed to discipline soldiers without its entire reputation being defamed.
And the pro-establishment narrative from Al Jazeera. The Netzah Yehuda battalion has a long and recorded history of egregious human rights violations, so it's no surprise that sanctions are finally being placed against it. There's even video footage of these soldiers abusing Palestinian detainees, which is why the U.S. government couldn't possibly turn a blind eye to these human rights violations.
And here's another nerd narrative from Metaculus. This one says there's a 17% chance that the International Criminal Court will bring charges against Benjamin Netanyahu before 2026. In our next story, the House approves a $61 billion Ukraine aid package. And here are the facts as agreed upon by Forbes, Al Jazeera, The New York Times, The Associated Press, and The Financial Times. The U.S. House of Representatives on Saturday voted 311 to 112 to approve sending $61 billion in foreign aid to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. The Ukraine aid is part of a $95 billion package, which includes $26 billion for Israel in its war with Hamas and $8 billion to support U.S. allies, including Taiwan, in the Indo-Pacific region. The military aid for Kyiv includes a provision that would allow the U.S. to sell seized Russian assets and transfer the funds to Ukraine. The National Aid Security Package will now go to the Senate, where it's expected to be approved on Tuesday. President Joe Biden has reportedly assured that he will sign it into law immediately. Saturday's vote comes as Russia has reportedly gained the advantage on much of the battlefield, as Ukrainian troops face a severe shortage of ammunition.
We've got a full house of narratives here, Melissa. Let's start with the pro-establishment narrative from The Washington Post. The much-awaited U.S. aid will help keep the Russia-Ukraine war from expanding as well as save thousands of lives. The measure was desperately needed as Kyiv had been running low on all weapons types, from small arms to air defense, and could lose the war within weeks. The U.S. resolve to back Ukraine will extend its window to fight and keep the negotiating table at bay.
Here's the establishment critical narrative from TASS. It's a bad day for anyone who believes that Ukraine can hold its own on the battlefield and inflict damage on Russia. The military aid to Kyiv will only enrich the U.S., ruin Ukraine, and result in more casualties. Moreover, allowing Washington to confiscate seized Russian assets and transfer the funds to Kyiv will worsen the crisis and risk leading to an unprecedented escalation in the region.
And the Republican narrative from The Hill. This multi-billion-dollar aid package is a sellout of America today. It's despicable that the U.S. is doing nothing to secure the U.S.-Mexico border, while the Democrats have been incessantly voting for foreign wars. For refusing to toe the party line and taking the aid to a vote for his betrayal and disloyalty, House Speaker Mike Johnson has jeopardized his position and will undoubtedly pay a hefty price.
Here's the Democratic narrative from CNN. Despite facing a right-wing rebellion, Johnson cleared away the biggest hurdle to Biden's funding request for Ukraine, which is struggling to stay afloat amid dwindling military supplies. Had the U.S. lawmakers turned their backs on Kyiv on Saturday, the consequences could have been devastating. The Russia-Ukraine war is a global threat to the U.S.'s security and the free world, which Washington can't afford to shrug off.
And finally, a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 25% chance that Ukraine will join NATO before 2035. Trump's hush money trial begins. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Fox 13 Tampa Bay, the Associated Press, and ABC 7 New York. On Monday, the hush money trial of former President Donald Trump, who's the presumptive Republican presidential nominee for this year's election, began in Manhattan with opening statements. Trump arrived in the courthouse around 9 a.m., addressing a camera and calling the trial a witch hunt before he entered the courtroom. The session was expected to last until 2 p.m. because of Passover, but was cut short at 12:30 p.m. because of a juror's dentist appointment. Prosecuting attorney Matthew Colangelo, representing Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office, accused Trump and his then-attorney Michael Cohen of agreeing to cook the books to make an alleged hush payment to Stormy Daniels look like payment for services rendered. Todd Blanche, a Trump attorney, countered that the former president is innocent and did not commit any crimes because Trump had nothing to do with a $420,000 payment to Cohen, who paid Daniels $130,000 to not speak about her alleged relationship with Trump. Lo then called David Pecker of the National Enquirer as the first witness, saying Pecker had direct knowledge of Trump's alleged scheme. Pecker is expected to return to the stand Tuesday.
Thank you, Scott. Here's the pro-Trump narrative from the Daily Caller. This case is only for public spectacle, and it's good that Trump's defense tore apart every aspect of it Monday. Prosecutors can't single out any crime Trump committed, but Bragg is politically motivated to try to sidetrack the former president's current run for a return to the White House.
MSNBC brings us the anti-Trump narrative. There was nothing groundbreaking about the opening statements, but prosecutors picked the perfect first witness. If Trump did what he's accused of doing, he was probably desperate enough to get the media involved, and Pecker's publication would have been the perfect outlet to turn in an effort to keep things under wraps.
And here's another nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 72% chance that Trump will be found guilty of at least one felony in his New York hush money trial. SCOTUS will hear the ghost guns case next term. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CNN, CBS, the Courthouse News Service, Fox News, Breitbart, and the New York Times. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed on Monday to take up the issue of whether the Biden administration can lawfully impose regulations on so-called ghost guns. The case will be argued in the Supreme Court's next term, which begins in October, as both the Biden administration and challengers to its rule have asked for a definitive decision on the issue. The justices will hear arguments over whether the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF, can require serial numbers on part kits and manufacturers and sellers to obtain federal firearm licenses. While Vanderstoke v. Garland proceeds, the Supreme Court has allowed the federal government to temporarily enforce the rule issued in 2022 by the ATF. Last November, a three-judge panel at the U.S. Fifth Circuit of Appeals unanimously found that the federal agency overstepped its bounds and went beyond Congress to redefine partially completed pistol frames as firearms. The sales of ghost guns, which can be assembled from do-it-yourself kits at a relatively inexpensive price, have seen an increase since the mid-2010s.
Thanks, Melissa. Narrative A on this story from Reason. Courts across the U.S. have found that the White House and regulators have made up illegal rules against privately made guns to tighten gun control, and hopefully the Supreme Court will decide the same way. Congress was fully aware of and expressly protected the long-established tradition of at-home gun-making in the Gun Control Act of 1968.
Here's Narrative B from the National Review. Whether you like it or not, the ATF does have the statutory grounds to enforce the Gun Control Act of 1968, which defines a firearm as any destructive device, including a combination of parts that can be readily converted to expel a projectile. Motivations for the rule and effectiveness may be questioned, but not its legality.
And the nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 50% chance there will be at least 1.41 small firearms per capita in the USA by 2029. Global military spending reached an all-time high in 2023. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by The Guardian, CNBC, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, and DW. A report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, published Monday, said global military expenditure totaled $2.443 trillion in 2023, an all-time high. Spending soared 6.8% in real terms relative to 2022, marking the largest annual increase since 2009, which was also the last year military expenditure increased in all five geographical regions defined by SIPRI. The U.S. continued to account for most of the world's spending at 37%, while China, which increased its spending by 6%, made up 12% of global military spending. Nan Tian of SIPRI said the rise is due to a global deterioration in peace and security. At $916 billion, the U.S. pays 68% of NATO's $1.341 trillion expenditure, but some of the alliance's European members have increased their spending. Meanwhile, Japan and Taiwan each increased spending by 11% amid simmering tensions with China. Russia, the third highest, and Ukraine saw increases relative to 2022 at 24% and 51% respectively. Meanwhile, Poland had the largest increase at 75%. Middle Eastern tensions spurred increases in the region as Israel's spending jumped to $27.5 billion, a 24% increase. While wars in Gaza and Ukraine led to the expected increases in Europe and the Middle East, analysts were surprised by increases in Latin America and Africa. Military spending in those regions is often used to combat widespread organized crime and gang violence.
Thank you, Scott, for those facts. Here's the establishment critical narrative from Anti-War. This report confirms what we already knew about the increase in global military spending led by the U.S.'s outdated neoconservative foreign policy. For the past 2 years, the U.S. has been funding a proxy war with Russia that has killed thousands of Ukrainians, and now it's allowing Israel to instigate a war with Iran that could bring mass destruction. It's time for the U.S. to stop its endless thirst for war.
The pro-establishment narrative comes from the New York Times. There's been an erosion of diplomacy across the world led by Russia and Iran's aggression. That has left the free world with little choice but to increase military spending in order to, among other things, help Ukraine fend off Russia. While peace is the ultimate goal, there must be increased commitment to security during these troubling times. The rules-based world order must be fostered and reinforced.
And the nerds are at it again with another narrative saying there's a 50% chance that at least 2.4% of world GDP will be spent on military expenses in 2030.
Who is getting the money? It takes two to transact. All these military spendings, this huge amount of money, who are these countries buying from? Like, who's getting the money?
I'm pretty sure government, military, defense companies.
Like American defense companies, or there's companies all over the world?
Probably all over the world, but Raytheon is probably the biggest one.
Because you would think if the world's going to spend all this on war, like I guess if they're all spending it back to America, that's a pretty good deal for economically.
Well, that's kind of the argument, right? That's kind of the criticism, right? Is that these people are not advertising that it's really good for their pockets and their bank accounts. Pro-Palestine student protests expand from Columbia to New England colleges. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CBS, NBC Boston, NBC Connecticut, the Boston Herald, and USA Today. Ongoing protests supporting Palestine and against the ongoing conflict in Gaza have continued at Columbia University and begun at other U.S. campuses in the New England area, such as MIT, Tufts University, and Emerson College. Students in the greater Boston campuses began protesting around 7 p.m. local time on Sunday in support of the Columbia demonstrations. In addition, in New Haven, Connecticut, at least 47 people were arrested Monday from among several hundred protesting at Yale University. Additionally, Harvard University has closed its campus to the public after demonstrations Friday in solidarity with Columbia protesters. Harvard officials reportedly took the action, quote, out of an abundance of caution and with the safety of our community as a priority. Meanwhile, at Columbia, the university moved classes online Monday over fears of disruption. The New York Police Department said that no additional arrests had taken place around the perimeter of the university, with the last arrest occurring Saturday night. 108 demonstrators were arrested at Columbia University Thursday by the NYPD, after police dismantled a pro-Palestinian tent encampment.
The MIT faculty newsletter brings us the pro-Palestine narrative. Student groups are advocating the liberation of Palestinians and the Gaza war have for months faced challenges in discussing Palestine openly at various major U.S. campuses due to censorship concerns. Such student groups at Columbia, MIT, Tufts, and other campuses have turned more vocal in an unprecedented manner. This grassroots human rights movement is getting the long overdue attention of the political and higher education establishment.
The pro-Israel narrative from the New York Times. Complaints of anti-Semitism at elite universities like Harvard and MIT reveal systemic issues. Jewish students have, in recent months, faced threats, assaults, and intimidation on campuses with allegations of biased treatment and safety concerns. Upholding legal obligations to protect students from harassment is crucial. Emphasizing the need to address anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias effectively in academic settings to ensure a safe and inclusive environment for all.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 70% chance that Israel will have de facto power in the Gaza Strip by January 1st, 2025. President Muizu's party wins parliamentary polls in the Maldives. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by BBC News, Al Jazeera, AFP, Associated Press, and Reuters. According to preliminary results Monday, Maldivian President Mohamed Muizu's People's National Congress Party has won the country's parliamentary elections, winning 71 of 93 seats. The main opposition, Maldivian Democratic Party, led by former President Ibrahim Mohamed Soli, won 15 seats in Sunday's vote. It held an absolute majority in the previous parliament with 65 seats. With about 73% of eligible voters casting ballots, the Election Commission of the Maldives said voter turnout was lower than the 82% recorded in the 2019 parliamentary elections. Formal ratification of the results is expected to take a week, while the new parliament will likely take office in early May. China and India each watch this election closely. Soli is seen as pro-India. Muizu, who after winning the presidency last year, ordered Indian troops stationed on one of the Maldives' islets to go home, belongs to the pro-China camp.
Thank you, Scott. Here's narrative A from the First Post. With Muizu's party securing a supermajority, it's clear voters have strongly endorsed his pro-China stand. Now he has the political muscle to reduce India's long-standing influence on the Maldives, push forward a more balanced foreign policy, and foster closer economic and defense cooperation with global powerhouse China.
Narrative B comes from Frontline. Unfortunately, this vote will accelerate the Maldives' shift away from traditional ally India in favor of China, which has been aggressive on the world stage. Plus, Muizu's two-thirds majority in parliament could allow him to destroy the country's democratic values. He can amend the constitution, control the judiciary, and compromise national sovereignty by giving China too much influence.
And the nerds have another say from Metaculus. There's a 15% chance that there will be a China-India war by January 1st, 2035. I was watching a special about one of the islands on the Maldives that has to deal with this constant erosion, just like knocking people's houses away that they put all their money into, right? Because the ocean waters are rising and the topography's changing. So, like, you know, the whole thing is about, you know, what do we do? Do I, you know, neighbors come together and build a new wall around my house, or do I move and lose my family?
Well, I took a vacation in Jamaica last year. It was the week that the Chinese spy balloon was happening, I remember, because I didn't read a single story on this show about the Chinese balloon. So you would go on this beach. It was lovely. But one day I woke up extra early and I saw people shoveling sand on the beach. And I think every morning they're just shoveling fresh sand on this beach. Because it's just this resort, you know, like we say we have a beach at this resort.
Right.
We have to have this beach.
Yeah. When we built this resort in the 70s, we had a great beach and we want to keep it that way.
Every morning we're fighting. And it feels like if they miss one day, it'll never come back or something. You know, they were shoveling. So, yeah.
That's why don't you move? Well, because I put millions of dollars into this location.
Resort. I own this resort, not the one somewhere else, so I'm going to buy sand. Now, on the other hand, if you go to the Jersey Shore...
Oh, now we're talking my kind of vacation.
There's too much sand. You have to walk so far to get to the water.
Oh, I think that's the coolest thing.
You have to, like, just drive your truck or something. Like, you have to walk for the boardwalk to... Which beach was it? At Wildwood.
Yeah.
You have to walk far to get to the ocean. Like,
yeah, but you can have ultimate frisbee tournaments on that beach.
No, I'm fine with it, but it just goes, all that sand that's washing away from Jamaica must just be washing straight to Wildwood. Like, that's where it's going. He could, like, lose a few inches. Like, it would be fine. Meanwhile, they're fighting for every centimeter down in Jamaica.
That sounds like a metaphor of, so. Are you trying to say something?
Nah.
An Australian Senate committee calls for a royal commission into the nation's COVID response. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Guardian, the Australian Human Rights Commission, the Australian Senate, ABC Australia, and the Royal Commissions. Australia's Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee has recommended the creation of a royal commission into the country's handling of the COVID pandemic. Published on April 19th, the report claims there's overwhelming support for a royal commission. Just 3 of 559 committee submissions didn't support its establishment. The report continues that a royal commission would assist in restoring public trust in the country's governance, while claiming the Australian public is owed a better understanding of specific pandemic measures. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, in September, announced a 12-month inquiry into the COVID pandemic, claiming he was advised against a royal commission as it can take more time. Australia's current inquiry has been criticized by the country's Human Rights Commission for excluding unilateral actions by state and territorial governments, including lockdowns, border and school closures, and mask mandates. A royal commission is described by the Australian government as the highest form of inquiry created in rare and exceptional circumstances, with the ability to determine its own procedures.
Australia's Institute of Public Affairs brings us the establishment critical narrative. Australia's government continues to break its promise of providing its people the COVID inquiry they deserve. Australia's current shallow investigation, led by political appointees, is not reliable. The country's elite continues to shy away from providing real answers about their decision-making during the pandemic.
And the Sydney Morning Herald brings us a pro-establishment narrative. A royal commission would be reliant on the cooperation of all states and territories to achieve meaningful results, and would by no means guarantee valuable information. Regardless of format, Australia's inquiry must encourage honest reflection for the process to be of any value.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 50% chance the WHO will announce the COVID-19 pandemic has ended by April 2025. Our final story, Tesla cuts the price of several models. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, USA Today, The Independent, and the Associated Press. Elon Musk-owned electric vehicle maker Tesla on Saturday announced it's cutting around a third off the price of its full self-driving system from $12,000 to $8,000 in the latest sign the company is facing an uphill battle to thrive. The cut in price of the full self-driving system, which, contrary to its name, does not drive the car itself, comes a day after Tesla announced it was cutting $2,000 off the price of three of its U.S. models, the Model X, Model Y, and Model S. Price cuts were also made to the Model 3 in China and Germany, in addition to cuts in other countries in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. Tesla reportedly had a rare year-over-year decline when it produced more than 433,000 EVs in its latest quarter, but delivered around 387,000. The company will announce its first quarter earnings Tuesday after markets close. This comes as Tesla is in the midst of a price war with other EV makers, especially those in China. Tesla also last week announced plans to lay off 10% of its global staff and had to recall thousands of Cybertrucks because of safety issues.
Thank you, Scott, for those facts on our final story. Narrative A comes from Forbes. The sky seems to be falling for what was once Musk's business crown jewel. The price cuts, layoffs, and recalls have continued Tesla's dismal slide, during which its value has decreased and sales have dropped. With a bruising earnings report expected out this week, Musk can't seem to figure out how to stop this tailspin.
Narrative B comes from Barron's. It's a tough week for Tesla, and the week ahead may be rough too, but there are signs of hope because of a possible increase in demand for an updated Model 3, and the potential Musk will soon announce a lower-priced Model 2, which could be extremely popular. Tesla is trying to price its EVs to better fit U.S. budgets, and it's getting there.
And here's the nerd narrative from Metaculus, saying there's a 50% chance that Tesla will report producing 3.37 million vehicles in 2025. Scott? You going to go for it?
I think I'm going to wait for the price to go down even more. You know, I'm a patient. I've waited this long. Let's see if it slides further. I'm all for this price decline, you know, personally, but I'm worried it might lead to like variable, like dynamic, like what airline tickets are, that the price just goes up and down every day. You know, you buy it on a Tuesday, it's this much. Wednesday, I don't need that in my life.
Yeah, that is a lot to manage. You need a major domo for that.
Oh, for sure. God, I need that for everything.
Thank you for listening to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024.
Each day, we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers to figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
To find out more about Verity, visit our website, verity.news. You can also download our app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Melissa Topshire, inviting you to join us next time on Verity.